Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California today. And as always, I'm joined by...
From Houston, Texas, the Taliban-occupied Texas, as I call it, which is going to get much worse tomorrow. It's Bob Bazanko, as always. And we always start by just kind of telling you how much we appreciate the support we got. And it's really kind of ramped up lately. Especially on YouTube, we are now getting like 8,000-9,000 views for our shows on YouTube. We're up to 2,000 subscribers. We're getting like 500 likes. We realize these are not New York numbers, but we don't have New York resources and New York support and, you know, that kind of New York lefty cred. But we are doing things that no one else is doing. So we really appreciate all the support we're getting and continue to get. Please share this, subscribe wherever you're looking or listening to it. Rate and review it. That helps the algorithms. Like it. You know, follow on social media. And we know times are tough out there, but if you have a few bucks, like literally a few bucks a month, you can also be a financial supporter and hear history and hear interviews with the kinds of people you probably aren't going to get anywhere else, like today's awesome show. So, and in the past, I mean, just in the past few weeks, we've had an amazing show, the Cuban Missile Crisis. We talked to Noam Chomsky recently, and he'll be on again soon, I think. Did a great shows with Scott's. Scott's done some great shows on environmental activism. Talked to Mike Elk live from Brazil the other day. So we really got our A-game going, and we may be kind of a small, kind of boutique type podcast, but we are good. We're really good.
And we're scrappy.
We're scrappy as hell.
Yeah. And if you want to donate and become a donor of the Green and Red Podcast, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button. You can become a one-time donor, or you can go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/greenredpodcast and become a recurring donor for $3 a month. It makes you a comrade. Why wouldn't you want to do that? It's less than a cup of coffee in the San Francisco Bay Area or in the Montrose in Houston. Mm-hmm. And then we're also cheaper. And cheaper. And we also have a special deal we're running right now. We've had Daniel McGowan on, who is a member of the Certain Days Political Prisoners Calendar Collective. And so we bought a number of those. And so for a donation of $25 or more to the Green and Red Podcast, we will mail you one of these 2023 Certain Day Freedom for Political Prisoners calendars. And so definitely like check us out that. We got a nice little number of those to give away. So just like support the Green and Red Podcast.
It could be more than 25 too.
Yeah, 25 or more. 25 or more, right? And so kind of getting into today's episode, we're going to be talking about another environmental issue. We're going to be talking about mining, just mining, responsible mining. We're going to talk about actually how dirty some of the clean energy and renewable energy sector might be. We've been seeing a drive, no pun intended, toward the growth of renewable energy, towards the renewable energy sector, you know, expansion of people being able to buy electric vehicles, things like that. But we're also, you know, seeing that as a new iteration of corporate liberalism, which allows the state to expand markets, and in this case, for renewable energy. But this is at a cost that's related to justice and health of communities in or near areas extracting these materials for the renewable sector. And then the most recent example, which hopefully we'll get into a little bit, is the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, which actually created a lot of initiatives for the purchase of electric vehicles, et cetera. The IRA actually provided $27 billion in funding for accelerating clean energy technologies. So the question we're going to be talking about today is, we're seeing this growth in government-funded growth of renewable and clean energy. How clean is it really? And so to talk to us about that today is Raquel Dominguez, who works at Earthworks as the Circular Economy Policy Advocate. And so Raquel is joining us from the East Coast today. And Raquel, welcome to Green and Red.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm curious, just to kind of kick it off with a question, I'm curious about the term circular economy. Can you tell us what that term means, actually, just to start off with a little bit?
Yes, I would be happy to. So the world economy currently operates under what's called a linear model, and that's predicated on three main principles: take, make, waste. The take part, the extraction part, is constantly increasing because in a linear economy, things are not designed for more than one use. So it's maximum extraction, some amount of use, and then maximum amount of waste. A fossil fuel economy is by definition a linear economy because it can't be reused, right? So obviously constantly increasing extraction puts enormous strain on the communities near the sites of extraction, as well as the natural resources they rely on. And so switching to a renewable energy economy under a linear model will be catastrophic for a lot of extraction affected communities. So I'm advocating for what's called a circular economy, which is a different kind of economy model. And in a circular economy model, waste and extraction are both minimized as much as possible. Theoretically, they could get down to zero, but the use is prioritized. Use of any product is prioritized through recycling, reusing, substitution, refurbishment, et cetera. There's a lot of theory in there, or there's a lot of circular economy theory coming out right now. And sometimes they'll talk about like the three R's, and sometimes they'll go into like R15 or something. And I can't tell you what they all are. But basically it means just ensuring that products that are in use right now are in use for as long as possible. And that whenever they do have to be disposed of, they're done so in a way that keeps them within the existing resource loops. This significantly eases the strain on extraction and waste affected communities all around the world, which are unsurprisingly disproportionately Black, Brown, Indigenous, poor, et cetera. In the U.S., it's overwhelmingly Indigenous communities when it comes to mining in particular. So the think tank MSCI has found that 97% of nickel, 89% of copper, 79% of lithium, and 68% of cobalt reserves and resources in the U.S. are located within 35 miles of a Native American reservation. So switching to a renewable energy-based economy under a linear model will hit those communities the hardest.
And what kind of products are we talking about that these minerals are going into, just to give the audience an idea of what they might be using that's related to this, to these issues?
Yeah, so I wanna preface this by saying, and this is not false modesty, but I'm not a battery scientist or a chemist or anything like that. But what we're talking about is essentially anything that has a battery. So anything from your smartwatch to your smartphone to your laptop, all the way up to and including electric vehicles, EVs, solar panels, wind turbines, stuff like that. Things that are colloquially known as renewable energy technologies.
And when we're talking about the impact that these are having on communities, like Indigenous communities or other, like, you know, frontline Black and Brown, poor, low income communities, you know, what is the actual impact? It's going to be pollution. It's going to be water pollution, air pollution, et cetera.
Yeah. So there are so many effects. The one I always talk about first is that extraction, and in this case, hard rock mineral extraction, has very strong correlations with gender-based violence, particularly for Indigenous peoples. So in the US and in Canada, there's this movement called the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls movement. And you can expand that into not just women and girls, but also two-spirit folks, trans folks, queer folks, et cetera. And Indigenous people, particularly women and girls, have been for decades talking about the consequences of extraction on their communities. So at Earthworks, we are starting to put more emphasis on the experiences of those communities. We're starting to say more often and in every space possible, extraction has these particular consequences. So that's the one I always come to first. There's all water, air, and soil pollution effectively last forever. I mean, technically thousands of years, but in human life scales, that lifespans, that's effectively forever. It's also a massive threat to biodiversity, which is really important, particularly as we are in this not technically post-pandemic world. Biodiversity is a really one of the barriers between zoonotic diseases and more pandemics. That's just terrestrial mining. There's like deep sea mining is becoming more of a concern, and that would have like so many other consequences. I couldn't even talk about because they're still very unknown.
Well, yeah, the environmental destruction is obviously, you know, kind of really catastrophic and evident. It's also resource theft. I mean, I was telling you before we started, I'm a professor, and you know, when you talk about the so-called Indian Wars of the late 19th century, those things started because white, you know, gold speculators went into Lakota territory to take gold off of, you know, land that was not theirs by treaty. So, I mean, there's, if you, you know, and none of us, I think, actually are advocates of the kind of capitalist extractive economy, but even under those circumstances, you know, local peoples are being ripped off for potential, you know, potentially great wealth because, you know, these assets, and you can see this in mine, you can see this in Bureau of Land Management. I think people, I was telling you before, like when I teach, this is kind of a, it's not this, I was telling my students, this is not the sexiest topic you're ever going to hear, but it's as important as any, you know, like you have like West Virginia, which is really a wealthy state, which is incredibly impoverished because so few people actually have access to it. Anyway, sorry for that rant. I told you I do that occasionally, but.
You're right. So.
But you know, what kind of wealth are we talking here? I mean, you know, within, I think the numbers you mentioned, it sounds like 70-75% of these valuable extractive resources are within, you know, a few miles of native reservations. I mean, what are they losing out in this theft?
Oh man, that's a good question. So I think when I want to say maybe 20 years ago, Earthworks, my organization, did a calculation on how much money has been taken essentially out of the ground. And it's worth noting, like, I'll get into this whenever we talk about the 1872 mining law, but under that law, you don't pay any royalties. So it's essentially for free. And I think the calculation done like 20 years ago or something was like upwards of $300 billion. And I just want to be clear, we, as far as I know, there aren't any other numbers floating around. I haven't seen any, but I find it several hundred billion dollars has been, I hesitate to say taken from the taxpayer because this isn't our land. It doesn't belong to us. But under the legal framework of the United States, several hundred billion dollars worth of resources have been taken from under the ground, and they haven't had to pay any royalties, any taxes, anything for them.
And so the Inflation Reduction Act, which is, you know, accelerating the clean energy sector, right? You know, how is that going to affect some of these mining issues? Like, how is that going to accelerate resource theft? Is that going to accelerate pollution and destruction and, you know, the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls? Like, just comment on how the Inflation Reduction Act could potentially make this worse, where they're touting it as a solution to climate change and climate.
To kind of set the stage, the people who did the calculations for the emissions reductions that would come from the Inflation Reduction Act, they didn't calculate anything when it comes to mining. So that's just not in the equation at all. So there are these things called the 30D tax credits. What they do is they give you about $7,500 if you if you buy an EV, an electric vehicle. And what the IRA does is change those tax credits. And it says that starting in 2023, which is in less than 2 months, improbably, EVs have to have at least 40% of their battery minerals sourced from a free trade agreement country. And the State Department has a list of those countries. I don't remember them off the top of my head, but it's about 20 countries. Notably excluded is China, where the vast majority of battery mineral processing happens. So come next year, come January 1st next year, an EV cannot get this 30D tax credit if it has, if more than 60% of it has been sourced from or even goes through China. So that, and then those percentages increase over the next few years. In 2028, I think it finally plateaus at 80%. So again, in 2028, if less than 80% of the battery is either sourced from, processed in, or transported through non-free trade agreements like China, you don't get a tax credit, a 30D tax credit on that EV. So this is a pretty obvious way to incentivize domestic mining in the United States. Luckily, the IRA says that you can either source from free trade agreement countries or you can source from North American recycling. So we are trying to encourage the Treasury Department, which is, of course, the department in charge of implementing the IRA or these particular tax credits within the IRA. So we're trying to tell the Treasury Department, incentivize recycling, don't incentivize new extraction because of all of the reasons I just listed.
Yeah, I mean, the 1872 mining law actually seems to be like a big factor in this. And I know that there's been efforts to have reforms to it. One question I would have is like, why do we want reforms to it? Just to give us a little bit of a background on it. And then two, you know, what is the best use for it at this point, particularly with like this new, with the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, make a new incentive for people to mine lithium and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So I love talking about this. So in 1872, the U.S. had finished the Civil War less than 10 years earlier, and was rapidly and aggressively, and as you pointed out, violently expanding westward. In 1871, the government under Ulysses S. Grant stopped making treaties with indigenous tribes and nations. In 1872, they passed this law called the General Mining Law, the General Mining Act. I'll often call it like the 1872 law. And that law says that mining is the highest and best use of the land. And it's worth noting that in 1872, when this law was passed, it covered literally everything under the ground. It's been narrowed a lot since then. So it no longer includes oil, gas, coal, or any fuel resources. It does include platinum and lithium and copper. All of the stuff that's going to be covered by renewable energy, or that's going to be needed by renewable energy technologies. So they passed this law specifically designed to incentivize colonization and settlement of what we now call the West. Prior to the 1970s bedrock environmental laws like NEPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, et cetera, there were no environmental protections. There are no community protections. Like I said, mine operators or owners don't have to pay royalties. They don't have to post bond. They're not liable for any accidents they cause during mining or after mining operations. They're not liable for their tailings, which is the mine waste. It is an overwhelmingly sweet deal if you are a mining company. So in the 90s, Congress started passing a moratorium on privatizing mining claims. But under the law itself, you literally stick 4 stakes in the ground. And if you can prove that you have reason to believe that that land has copper underneath it, you automatically owned it. So it's wild. It's just absolutely wild because in 1872, first of all, most of us did not have rights. And second of all, mining was done with like actual human beings with pickaxes. Now mining is done with these gigantic machines that disturb billions of tons of dirt. Tailings piles are massive and miles long. It's a completely different scenario. And the fact that we're still
it seems rather outdated. It seems like a very outdated law.
It's like astonishingly so. It's ridiculous. And so literally since that law was passed, people have been trying to change it because it's ridiculous. And it's gotten more ridiculous in the literally 150 years since it's been passed. Back in April or May was the 150th anniversary of the 1872 mining law. So we are like, that mining law covers all so-called federal lands west of the Mississippi River. So that's like several billion acres of land governed by a rule that was written and passed by Ulysses S. Grant. It's just hilarious how archaic it is. It still exists. In the last couple of decades, for sure, every Congress or so, people have introduced a reform bill. In the last couple of years, the champion for that on the House side has been the chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, Raul Grijalva, out of Arizona. And currently it's Martin Heinrich, the senator from New Mexico, and before him it was Senator Udall. Every year it's introduced. It almost always gets a hearing, at least on the House side. And then it doesn't go anywhere because the mining industry has a lot of money. And when you have a lot of money, you know, bills don't move out of committee. Back in the Clinton administration, the environmental community was able to push some rule changes through in the Bureau of Land Management. The Bush administration came in and like within the first month changed them back. So yes, this Congress, both Senator Heinrich and Chair Grijalva introduced the current name for it is the Clean Energy Minerals Reform Act. And then there have also been some other developments. Earthworks and a bunch of other environmental organizations and 9 tribes submitted a petition last year to the Bureau of Land Management with red line edits of the Bureau of Land Management's rules implementing the 1872 mining law. So in particular, we were asking for an updated definition of undue degradation, unnecessary and undue degradation, and asking for land managers to have discretion to deny mines. So right now, legally, on land covered by the 1872 mining law, it's almost impossible to deny a mine, even if you are like the head of that U.S. Forest Service land. Like legally, you cannot deny that mine. Again, just absolutely wild. So we're really hopeful that they'll do something with that. And then this year, the Biden administration established this interagency working group on mining reform, and it was headed by Interior, but it also included agriculture and defense and a bunch of other agencies. So they collected comments from people who are involved in different parts of mining and mining extraction. So we submitted a bunch of comments to that, and they should be putting out recommendations on that sometime this year.
As the current Secretary of the Interior is an American Indian, Deb Haaland, has she done anything about this or talked about it? Or
so at South by Southwest this year, I want to say, what is time at this point? But I think it was this year. She talked about how her tribe, the Laguna Pueblo in so-called New Mexico, were and are located by what used to be the world's largest uranium mine, the Jackpile uranium mine. And she has talked about some of the consequences of that. And I don't know if you know anything about uranium mining, but it is horrifying. The things that have been done to indigenous people in the Southwest. I mean, just in general, horrifying, but uranium mining in particular is astonishing. So she's talked a little bit about that. She also has been present for like the Biden administration's their fundamental principles on mining reform, She has said some stuff about the interagency working group, but check me if I'm wrong, but to my knowledge, she hasn't said anything about reforming the mining law itself.
Let me follow up on that, Scott, and cut you off for a minute. Because you mentioned the uranium mine in New Mexico, what are some other areas that are like seriously affected by this, like specific, you know, geographic areas?
Yeah. So, like I said, Bureau of Land Management land is, the 1872 mining law covers most federal lands west of the Mississippi. So the Government Accountability Office actually did a report on this. So they have hard numbers. But from what I recall, some of the states with the highest amount of federal land in the West are like Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona. Alaska is a huge one. Like almost all of Alaska is federal land. And all of that land is available for mining. If people can prove they're mining, there's minerals under it.
I was just going to use the uranium mining as a dig at some of our podcast competitors, because what's troubling is we're increasingly seeing, you know, nuclear energy being touted as renewable energy and as a solution to climate change. And particularly within the sort of socialist podcast universe, they've really been talking about, like, you know, as long as it's like, you know, government-run nuclear power, central government, all of that sort of stuff, the nuclear energy is fine. And they're still using, you know, they use nuclear industry talking points, but it's like supposedly like socialists. Mm-hmm. And it's something Bob and I often like to rag on folks at another media outlet called Jacobin.
Air conditioning socialists and nuclear power socialists and Jacobin socialists. And now people associated with that crew want 500,000 more cops to make 7 million more arrests every year. But that's another story for another day. It's just I'm obliged to take a dig at these folks every time we're on.
We do dig, especially
like,
when
it's a personal thing.
Especially when power.
I mean, I would just ask, like, how can something be called a clean energy or a renewable energy when the waste has to be maintained and, you know, watched over forever? And
I don't think they heard of Fukushima, you know, where like,
yeah,
it's in the freaking water in Washington and Oregon, you know, so.
Hey folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast, where we interview guests like Noam Chomsky and Andrew Bacevich. We also have shows on cultural icons like Johnny Cash and Woody Guthrie and the Godfather movies. And we talk to scores of organizers and activists who tell us what is happening in the streets and in the back country. So check us out.
Yeah, and I'm Bob Bezanko. And as always, Scott and I want to thank you for listening, for watching, for supporting us. And we hope we continue to do that. The first thing we ask is that you share this. Let people know that we're out there and we're doing something that I think is different. We have a good niche, I think, in Left Podcast. And we talk to really cool people and about really important issues. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Go to our webpage, which is on in the screen. And you know, if you really like us, and if you have a little extra change around, jingles or folds, you can help us out by
going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button and make a one-time donation. Or you can check us out at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast and become a patron. We'll see you again real soon. Folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast. We're talking with Raquel Dominguez with Earthworks. And we're talking about the clean energy sector and how it's not that clean when it comes to mining issues. And we're talking about just mining, and we're talking about the impacts on communities. And we're now I'm going to ask a question about the, you know, the sort of like big booming mineral sector related to all of this, which is lithium. You know, and just doing a little research for this podcast, I saw that like Nevada alone has 17,000 claims for mines for lithium, and that we have the biggest and only active mine in the U.S. is Silver Peak, Nevada, at least as from what I've, as of this article that I was reading last night. And they're called, they call it white gold. It's the white gold boom, actually, is another thing that I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that a lot. And I know for a lot of people, not necessarily.
I say that tongue in cheek. I will say that tongue in cheek.
I figured. But so many people are like, yeah, lithium is white gold. And I always go, okay, well, what happened to the people who are in the way of the gold? Nothing good.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. No,
sorry. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, my question would be like, you know, because people use this in their cell phones, people are going to be buying electric vehicles with this, with government incentive or whatever. I'm wondering if you could just like tell us a little bit about this sort of like lithium mining boom that's going on right now, and particularly where it's impacting. And then I have some more specific follow-up questions.
Yeah, so right now, the leading battery technology is lithium ion batteries, because they are at the intersection of most commercially viable and also have the greatest amount of energy density, which is objectively incredibly important as we try to transition our electric grids to non-fossil fuel energy. The problem is that there is this assumption that we have to change our current fossil fuel powered society on a one-to-one ratio to one powered by rocks, essentially. And that is, again, that would be catastrophic for mining affected communities. That's especially true of cars right now. Like in the US, the assumption is, you know, every internal combustion engine vehicle is going to become an electric vehicle. There's been no major, like the climate change conversation in the US is like it surrounds the idea of EVs. Like that's it. There's very little discussion, especially in like the national policy level, about city densification, about massively expanding public transit, about massively expanding biking and walking infrastructure, and implementing policies to reduce car dependency. Not even like punishing people for having a car, because I don't think that's what a good use of time, but just like reducing the need to have a car. Like I said, I'm from the Midwest, and I went to school in St. Louis. You have to have a car. There is no functional public transit there. I live in Washington, D.C. right now. I don't have a car, and it's great. And the public transit system is, on the best of days, fine. Like, that should not be the norm. We should not have accepted that. And so because there is this widespread assumption that cars and everything else about our current society has to be exactly the same way under a renewable energy powered economy, there are these terrifying, massive demand projections for lithium and for copper and graphite and other battery minerals. But the thing is, those demand projections first of all, they're just projections. They're not set in stone, although a lot of people will have you believe otherwise. And second of all, society is changing all the time. It can change all the time, and it should change all the time. So assuming that the way things are now is how things are going to be in 10 years, never mind 50 or 200 years, is inaccurate. So what I'm doing at my job is advocating for a reduction of extraction in the first place by saying we should do more public transit. We should take all the money you're giving to mining companies right now, and you should put it into battery recycling facilities. And I'm saying, how can we build out collection infrastructure? How can we build out second life infrastructure? How can we demand original equipment manufacturers extended product responsibility, things like that. Like, there's so many policy levers to pull here. And so it's really frustrating when you see a lot of people who do care about the climate crisis and who do care about the environment saying, well, we just need to mine more because we just need more renewable energy technology because we need more EVs. It's usually EVs. And I say, well, do we though? Or are there ways we can change our lives keeping the same standard of living, for the record. I like Wi-Fi. But how can we change things to better live within the planetary limits?
So specifically, we're going to talk about mining. You said it displaces, you know, billions of pounds of dirt. But I'm assuming I know a little bit about fracking because they were going to do that where I'm from in Ohio. And I mean, some of those chemicals, many of which, you know, they're not obliged to even reveal, are incredibly toxic. And so when we're talking about kind of mining lithium or whatever, copper, what kinds of what's the impact of that in terms of kind of the environmental pollution? I'm assuming it's getting into the groundwater. I'm assuming cancer rates and, you know, neonatal problems are higher. I mean, what's actually the real life consequence of this kind of unregulated and unbridled mining boom?
Yeah, there are higher cancer rates. There are higher public health consequences, just generally speaking. I'm not going to try to pretend I know specifically, but I, you know, like I said, it effectively poisons water forever.
Yeah.
Like there are places that indigenous people still can't fish, and they haven't been able to fish for like decades, if not like more than 100 years, because of mining. In the West, 40% of the headwaters of Western watersheds have been polluted by hard rock mining. In 2015, there was the Gold King mine in Colorado, which was a mine that had gone bust like several decades ago. There was a tailings spill washed into the Colorado River. You can't use that water to irrigate. You can't use it to drink. You can't use it to bathe. And that is, it's especially astonishing when I hear you say, you know, Nevada has however many lithium claims right now. 17,000 lithium claims right now. All of those require an incredible amount of water, differing degrees, definitely. But the West is running out of water. The entire world is going to run out of water in the next, you know, to a certain degree, in the next several centuries. So it is especially wild to me that, you know, we're putting all of our eggs in the basket of further extraction when that extraction removes water from the hydrological cycle permanently.
Gold mining uses cyanide, which occasionally will kill an entire river of fish. I've also read studies where, you know, cancer rates are high, but the rate of birth defects is quite high as well, and like autoimmune diseases and things like that. So
yeah,
it's obviously a very serious issue that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, which is why like what you're doing is really, really great.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, the I think I said this earlier, mining is 10% of greenhouse gas emissions according to the United Nations Environment Program. So I'm not near an extraction affected community, but I'm probably breathing the air that was produced by a mining machine. And the people living around mining obviously have the worst health impacts because, again, when the mining law in the US was first passed, people were using pickaxes. I do this because I've never seen an actual pickaxe, so I don't actually know what it does. But like now there are these giant machines that are belching out smoke. Yeah, just like, I don't know. I've seen, I'm trying to think of a movie that has mining in it. I try to avoid those now for obvious reasons.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre, highly recommend it.
Okay, good to know. But like,
Nate,
you know,
Nate Wong.
Nate Wong, yeah.
Yeah, these machines are producing lots of smoke that's very hazardous to breathe in, and people can't just leave. And you know, and that's especially true for a lot of indigenous people who are often like spiritually connected to the land around them, the land that's being desecrated. We can't just say, okay, we'll just leave. That's not a good answer.
And just to shift a little bit, like what, you know, on the, in these communities, what sort of resistance to these mining practices are we seeing to these companies, to, you know, government agencies letting lithium miners come do whatever they want?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just like any other extractive industry where we're seeing a variety of tactics used. You know, there's lawsuits every single day on this, and those are really important. I think it also you know, these the really big mines have to apply for permits at like multiple different levels of government, and being able to pursue legal strategies against each level of government and each like agency or department is a really good strategy. It's also very expensive. So on my water bottle, I have this Life Over Lithium sticker, which is it's a sticker from the People of Red Mountain, which is an organization of Indigenous people in near Pehemaha, which is also known as where the Thacker Pass mine is being sited. And I'm really worried about what's going to happen there. Like I said, Indigenous peoples have been like, they've been called barriers to progress all over the world all the time. And with like the clock running out on a lot of, things in general, because of the climate crisis, I'm really worried that what people are going to do to force these mines into existence. And that's why I think it's so important that governments at every level start pushing circular economy policies now, so we can start reducing extraction dependence now and not in 50 years when we're running out of water.
I have to say, I wasn't as aware of the kind of domestic mining issues that you just brought up. Like I told you, I teach foreign policy. So to me, you know, when I talk about that, it's about kind of a lot of it is actually about the United States versus China with regard to lithium in Bolivia or rare earth minerals in Afghanistan all over. And obviously the U.S. kind of sees these at risk because, you know, especially the Chinese are coming in and offering really good deals to various governments. Does that mean it's more likely that we're going to see actually a significantly increased mining in the U.S. to make sure that there's a domestic source of these minerals?
The mining industry would certainly hope so.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of policies like the IRA, but not exclusive to the IRA, that are being developed specifically to incentivize mining in the U.S. I cannot say whether that will be successful or not, especially because people are willing to put their bodies on the line for this.
The voters of Bolivia screwed it up because they ended up reelecting socialists, even though Elon Musk said, we will coup whoever we want. So,
that is an entirely separate conversation and I think, like I was saying earlier, borders are such a, they're both entirely so relevant to this conversation, and they're entirely meaningless at the same time, because one battery is sourced from like 13 different countries. I'm just picking a number, but it's a lot of different countries. And then it's processed in three different places. And then it's shipped through like 17 different countries. And then it's put in a smartwatch in one country, and then it's sent to a million other countries. And these supply chains are incredibly opaque and incredibly complicated. And, there really isn't a difference between domestic and foreign mining anymore. I think there used to be, but not at this level of capitalism. And so I think the key here for mines in the US and for mines in Bolivia and for processing plants in China and for indigenous communities fighting all of those things everywhere is solidarity with all of them, regardless of, as you were saying, what the ruling class is trying to tell us is what's in our best interest and what isn't.
I have two more questions, which is more around responses, reactions to this work, to like mining campaign. One is, you mentioned a couple of times about how like, and I'm going to assume this is like more mainstream elements within like climate movement within the nonprofit industrial complex are very much like, we can mine our way out of this climate crisis. And I'm kind of curious if you have any experience with like, what has your experience when you talk with like, what I would call like climate liberals and nonprofits when you talk to them about these issues? And then I have a second question sort of like that.
Oh, yes. I get a lot of, you just must be in favor of the climate crisis, which is, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. You know, that's just very funny. I think I am always and consistently surprised by how many people cannot imagine even a like moderately different world than the one we live in right now. So like I've been getting really into like reducing car dependency and the importance of that, not just for mining impacts, but also for public health reasons, for pedestrian violence reasons, for city gentrification reasons, like all of these very connected things. And people are just like, no, that's just not possible. And I go, okay, well, in the US until the 50s, we actually led streetcar ridership in the world. No. Well, it's actually better for children if we don't have cars. No, you know, and in the US, that's, you know, we have a very particular way of looking at cars. Like car companies have spent generations drilling home the idea that like a car means freedom and a car means America and a car means you're a rugged individual and all this nonsense. And so it has been honestly really frustrating in a lot of cases. I find a lot of people are very open-minded. So like whenever I do talk about the mining law of 1872 and the harms of mining and the connections to gender-based violence, people very generally are like, oh my, first of all, I had no idea. And second of all, oh my God, that's so horrible. I don't want that to continue. But very often that's where it stops. Like that really sucks. But we do need renewable energy. We do need EVs. We do need et cetera, et cetera. And I just go, okay, well, we don't need those things at the scale you're saying. We don't need EV. We do not all need our own EV. We do not need to change every car we currently have into an EV. And ultimately what it really boils down to is that like a circular economy, even like the kind of filtered form that nonprofits are talking about, is like reshaping the entire fabric of society, particularly for consumerist capitalist countries in the global north. And that is, you know, that's unsettling. It's uncomfortable, right? I also think it's ultimately a very good thing because the status quo sucks for a lot of people. It's horrible. And you want to maintain the status, like we have this pivot moment to change so many things, not all at once, not quickly, not easily. And I get that. But we have this unprecedented opportunity to shift, not just into a new kind of dependency, but into a completely new type of economy that has the potential to make things better, tangibly, materially, within like a relatively short amount of time for massive amounts of people. We have the potential to significantly reduce extraction, to significantly reduce the public health impacts of mineral processing, to significantly reduce the harms caused by waste. And you just want to tell me that's too hard? You just want to tell me that like we don't have the political capital, all those things? And it just shows a real lack of imagination that has been really disappointing. But I will say, almost every conversation I've had like one-on-one with somebody, even people I don't know well, I tell them about this stuff and they go, oh, I had never thought about that. And they're not hostile to it. They've just never thought about it. And I do think that there are more and more people just realizing that there are different ways to shape society. And I think that that will continue. And I've had a lot of really good, interesting conversations about this kind of thing. But for me, it really just boils down to like, are you okay living in a world where you know there are sacrifice zones? And are you okay building a world where you know there are sacrifice zones? And I'm not.
And here in Texas, the Republicans are running ads. I mean, the Republican Party has said that people should be willing to die for the oil companies. I'm not making that up. They're running ads now attacking the Democrats for not being, you know, supportive of enough of the oil companies. You know, 700 people died in a deep freeze a couple of years ago. And, you know, the Republican response was, you know, hey, people should be willing to die rather than regulate our oil companies. So if you're not oil dependent enough, then you get attacked as being too radical for Texas. So
yeah,
it's we're at ground zero here. It's really scary.
Yeah. It's been when I first started at Earthworks, I was mostly working on oil and gas stuff. And My dad's actually from Texas, from a little town called Belton near Waco. And a lot of my family members actually work in oil and gas. And the first time I went down to visit them, like in mid-2020, I was like really anxious. I was like, you know, what if they're mad at me? What if they yell at me? All this stuff. First of all, they did not care a little bit. They were like, oh, we haven't seen you in 3 years. It's so cool to see you. But then like second, for a lot of those people, like it was, not to give them excuses, but like it was the only really good paying job. And I'm not saying that's like an acceptable reason to work in an industry that harms other people, but I am saying that like the government has not worked to give them other options. And so it will take a, yeah. Texas
well, it pays well. Yeah, I don't know.
It pays well.
Yeah,
it does. It they're often very shitty jobs, admittedly, mm-hmm. from what I can tell. But yeah, it does pay well.
Mm-hmm. My other question around the around reactions to this sort of work is we've also seen, I think it's particularly relevant in the West, but other places too. We've seen the rise of, you know, right wingers who are concerned about climate issues. And I believe actually at least one of these resistance camps, we saw people with some of these leanings, but like how much you see like eco-fascism, all of that sort of like kind of playing in to campaigns and in, especially in those parts of the rural West.
Oh man, you ever want to talk about eco-fascism, please hit me up. I have a weird interest in stuff like that.
We hopefully have a show coming up on it at some point in the future.
Okay, cool. Also, have you ever heard of the book Fossil Fuel Fascism by Andreas Malm? He wrote How to Blow Up a Pipeline, but this is a much bigger book about the connections between fossil fuels and fascism, obviously. Anyway, where do I even start with this? So I come from this very particular context of being a 27-year-old in a climate crisis affected world for everything that means and says. And I have been aware my entire life that this is happening and it's getting a lot worse. And generally speaking, people in power are not doing anything to stop it. And in a lot of cases, they're furthering the crisis. And so I've always been aware to a certain degree that, you know, there are less and less resources. And I was in my senior year of college when Trump was elected. So this is just the my context. But the point is that a right wing white supremacy resurgence is not that surprising to me. Things have been getting like steadily worse my entire life. And my dad used to tell me when I was in high school that around 2045 is when the collectively Black people, Indigenous people, and other people of color would outnumber white people. And when I was in high school, my dad was like, white people are aware of this, etc. And so I've always known that there is this like strong under for me for a long time, it was an undercurrent of hate. But it's been getting much louder my entire life. And what I'm trying to get at is ecofascism is not that surprising. It's a pretty logical end game if you start from the assumption that white people deserve things and white people don't have enough things. And there are a lot of intersections within that. There's a lot of misogyny, a lot of transphobia, a lot of anti-Semitism. Go down the list of oppressions, a lot of ableism especially. But it generally boils down to white people of a certain group deserve things and the rest of us don't. And I think it's always been kind of scary to say that. Kind of like acknowledging it makes it more real. But it's been like a very steady increase my entire life. And so I've actually, like, since I've been at Earthworks, I've been talking about ecofascism a lot. And, I actually just, co-wrote this blog about ecofascism in environmental spaces, even like progressive leftist spaces, even liberal spaces. Because I think a lot of people, like, if you're not on, like, if you're not on guard for it, then it's kind of easy to get infiltrated by fascist thoughts, even in your own head, and then actual fascists, like, in the world. Like, you know, there are people saying, like, we should just destroy industrial civilization. Okay, but the overwhelming majority of people who live in cities across the world are not white. So who is that going to harm the most? How is that going to harm disabled people the most? How is that going to harm trans people the most? How is that going to harm women the most? And I just refuse to believe that just, like, the only way forward is destroying everything. And so that's why it's really important that like more mainstream kind of, like, you know, well-known environmental groups say, we do not stand for fascism. We will not tolerate fascism. And that includes, we will not tolerate Islamophobia, transphobia, ableism, et cetera. We will not accept things. We will not accept assumptions about, like, oh my God, I can never say this correctly. The Malthusian, the overpopulation nonsense.
Yeah.
We're not going to even give that oxygen. Yeah. And I think it's going to be increasingly important that organizations that are just, like, kind of run-of-the-mill nonprofits say, we won't deal with this, and then back it up and say, we're not going to work with fascists. We're not going to work with people who may not call themselves fascist, but don't, like, recognize trans people, for example.
Where can they find that blog? Where can people find that?
Yeah. You can find it on the Earthworks website.
We can put it in the show notes too. That's one of the things I was reading, actually, as I was prepping. I mean, because as a person who works in climate and environmental spaces and seeing, you know, people who are connected to more right-wing movements, like, they're not climate deniers because they actually see, but the what they see as being the cause of it is the issue. I think it's going to be for particularly because we're talking about mining issues and in the West and. But we, you know, here we talk a lot about environmental and climate stuff, climate justice stuff. And so it's just something to, like, it's steadily been creeping in. And it's just, I think it's something that we all need to be more vigilant on.
Yeah. So, like, we linked to stories about this in the blog. But, like, the trigger warning for mass shootings. But I, like, the guy who shot up, who tried to kill a bunch of Latinx and Mestizex people in El Paso, Texas, and the Christchurch shooter, they in their manifestos, they both called themselves eco-fascist. Like, it's not just, like, hanging out on 8chan anymore. And I think a lot of people, you know, continue to prefer to believe that fascism in all its myriad forms is just, like, a thing that, you know, like, only like hardcore Nazis do, but, like, it's everywhere, and you have to be careful about it. You have to be careful about who you're working with.
Definitely. We're getting towards the end of our time. I'm gonna see if Bob has any last questions.
No, thanks. This has really been fantastic. It's really great. It's an important topic. Like I said, I talk about it a lot, and it's generally people don't really kind of know much about it. They're not taught much about it, and, you know, quite often, frankly, they're not all that interested in it. But I always tell them, you know, it's like, this is one of the most important things you can discuss. This is where power lies under the ground.
It's true. So. Like, yeah, working at this job has made me realize a very obvious thing, but I just had never, like, noticed, which is that, like, everything is actually about land, like land and water, et cetera. But, like, at the end of the day, what really matters is, like, what you can dig up.
Absolutely. Folks,
capitalism. You've been listening.
Capitalism.
Sorry. Thanks. This is really great. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was, yeah, I had fun.
Folks, you've been listening to Raquel Dominguez with Earthworks, talking about the circular economy and talking about renewable energy and how it's not as clean as you think it is and mining impacts communities, even for lithium and other things to power your electric vehicle. If you'd like what you're hearing, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit subscribe. And if you want to make a donation, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button, or go to Patreon and become a patreon.com/greenredpodcast and become a patron at our Patreon, because our Patreon rocks. You get all kinds of cool extras if you check it out. So we'll talk to all of y'all again soon. Misbehave. There's a lot of work ahead, and we'll talk to everyone again soon.